Hi, and welcome to my podcast number 8. And this time I'm going to begin with something that I haven't done at all before. I've played quite a lot of French records over the last few months. But now we're going to go to Brazil. Some of you may know that I'm a big, major Bossa Nova fan. But unfortunately, Bossa Nova only really started just as the 78 era was ending. There may be a few records on 78, I don't know. But I certainly don't have anything. But of course, Brazilian music didn't suddenly start in 1958, it goes right back into the 19th century. And MPB, Música Popular Brasileira, is really like a sort of a parallel to the development of North American music, and yet quite distinct from it. And it's certainly quite distinct from the rest of South America, the sort of music we tend to call Latin. I think Brazilians are vaguely annoyed if you lump their music in with Latin music, because it's in Portuguese and its influences are different, and I think it's much more sophisticated harmonically than most of the other music that you hear in South America. And the two basic forms were something called the choro, and of course in the 20th century behind everything is a rhythm called the samba, which if you slow it down a bit and add a few jazz chords becomes bossa nova. However, there were all sorts of things which, as I say, paralleled North America, including big bands. And I'd like to begin by playing you a recording made in 1947 by a band led by somebody called Severino Araújo, who was a reed player, sort of the Brazilian equivalent of Artie Shaw, if you will. And here, in just 3 minutes, they managed to do a fantastic shortened version of the famous Rhapsody in Blue. Now, I hope by now that you've got used to listening to 78s and that you realise that if they're not in perfect condition, you really can't get rid of all of the noise and all the background and all the mushiness. So I hope you'll be able to, for the first two tracks today, be able to listen through that noise and just enjoy the music. This is a fantastic track despite that. So I give you Severino Araújo in 1947 and his band and his amazing version of Rhapsody in Blue.
Thank you.
Severino Araújo, who enjoyed a long, long career and great musician. Incidentally, if you were to go to São Paulo, where I've been several times, São Paulo is a bit like New York, only not quite so quiet. It's absolutely amazing town. Every single corner seems to have a little underground nightclub with another genius in it. And if you think they aren't enough of a genius, you go to the next one and there's a bigger genius. The musicianship in Brazil is amazing. However, now to return to the world of opera. 100 years ago, of course, there was Caruso. And one thinks that he was some sort of unique phenomenon, but he wasn't. What he was at the top of a sort of giant pyramid, because all over Italy there were opera houses. In those days, with no microphones, you either had to be an opera singer or a musical performer, and either sort of performance required you to have a voice that would carry to the back of the largest theatres, because, as I say, no microphones, and you had to be heard over the pit band or orchestra. No, there were some great tenors all over Europe, and there are lots of them, any one of which would be a star today. Now, strangely amongst record collectors today, there's a sort of label snobbery I've found, and if the artist didn't regularly perform on, say, Victor, HMV, or Phonotypia, for some unknown reason, they seem to be subconsciously, as it were, downgraded in quality. The tenor I'm about to play did record on Victor, but he also recorded on various other labels. His name was Florencio Constantino. He was born in 1869 and he died in 1919. He must have had a pretty volatile sort of personality, and he could be very, very litigious. He could be quite aggressive. He could be very much what we might call prima donna, except he's a man. And he could be very, very generous. But the result of it all was that by the end of his career, people had got fed up with him, and towards the end of his life, his career went down to the dumps, and he was literally found lying drunk in the gutter, and was taken to hospital in Mexico City, where he died, which is a pity because he was a truly great singer. Possibly the highlight of his career, apart from singing for the Tsar in Russia, were his seasons in Boston, where Hammerstein, that's the father of the famous lyricist, was trying to run an opera house in competition with the famous Metropolitan. He couldn't get Caruso, but he got a whole load of other great singers, and standard was amazing. And some of these singers recorded quite a lot in the 1909-1910 season, and they recorded with Columbia. And Columbia, again, wasn't quite regarded as being as high-class a label for opera as Victor or HMV was. I think that's part of the reason why people don't take Constantino as seriously as they should. Well, here he is in 1909 singing wonderful aria Angelo Casto e Bel, and which you can compare if you have the recording with Caruso's version. Okay, he isn't Caruso, but who is? If he were singing today, he'd be the tenor, let me tell you that. He was able to sing anything from Rossini and the operas of Bellini, Donizetti, and all those early operas, right through to the new operas of Puccini and Mascagni. He could even do Otello, because I know he recorded some of the arias, and they're pretty damn good. He sounds to my ears like a sort of miniature version of the great Tamagno. He didn't have that volume and that breadth of sound, but something in the way he produces his voice reminds me of him at times. So I think he's one of the great tenors, and undeservedly perhaps forgotten. So here he is in 1909, Angelo Casto e Bel, and despite the mushiness of the sound here, I do hope you'll enjoy this wonderful singer.
Non turbi un po' la fede.
Florencio Constantino. Now, one can talk about his technique, of which there was a lot. He obviously understood a lot of bel canto technique, and he was a sort of link between the older tenors and Caruso's era. He was only 3 or 4 years older than Caruso, but somehow he's sort of a link between those two ways of singing. And of course, he sang with the greats of his era, Krushelnicka, Battistini, Ugue, lots and lots of great singers he sang with. But at the end of the day, I think some of his appeal is just something in the timbre which, as they say, touches the soul. Well, if that was true about Constantino, of course it defines at least half the appeal of the great Billie Holiday, along with her wonderful ability to phrase and make everything sound like the blues. I'm going to play one of her lesser-known tracks. I have an album, literally an album of 78s, which deals with a sort of theatre piece, a very early theatre piece, written by Leonard Bernstein. And just one of the tracks in the album is sung by Billie Holiday, and it's a forgotten song, which I think is great. And it's called Big Stuff. And this is Billie with a sort of large orchestra and strings and everything. And I know the jazz purists would say, oh, well, we don't want to hear strings in jazz. But I think it's a great track, one of my favourites of hers. And ever since I discovered this, I've loved it. And so I'm going to play it for you today. It's Billie Holiday in 1944, before her voice really began to sort of gradually fall apart, as I'm afraid it did over the years. This is Billie, what would she have been then, just about, well, just before her 30th birthday, probably, singing Big Stuff by Leonard Bernstein. Great track.
So you cry, what's it about? Maybe you ask why the blues had to go and pick you. So you go down to the shore, kid stuff. Don't you know there's honey in store for you? Big stuff. Let's take a ride in my gravy train. The door's open wide. Come in from out of the rain. So you stare, call it despair. Big stuff. Don't you dare, I'm on the square. Let's have a try. It may be that I'm the
The great Billie Holiday in 1944. Now, when you hear the Cockney accent of the next performer, what you're hearing is not the Cockney accent of today, but the Cockney accent of the 19th century. Cockney accent that you see written down in the books of Charles Dickens, when they still said wherry instead of very and so forth. This wonderful performer was called Gus Elan. He was born in 1862, and in his early years, long before he became a proper professional, he would sometimes take part in the Negro minstrel troupes that were playing in England, of all places, where there were hardly any black people living in those days, places like Margate and Ramsgate. And thus it was when he went into the business, he had a partner and they did blackface comedy. However, sadly, in 1891, his partner, who was called Daniels, died. Something happened in a boat and that was it, and he was on his own. And from then on, he dropped that blackface stuff and became a Cockney comedian with Cockney songs, what they called in those days a Costa comedian. And he went on, and he sort of retired for a while, and then had a sort of Indian summer. He came back, and he made some recordings in the late 20s and early 30s, and carried on pretty much until he died in 1940 at the age of, I think, 77. He was less maudlin than Albert Chevalier, who also was a famous Costa comedian. He was more sort of, don't mess with me, you know, I'm tough, mate, that sort of character. Now I'm going to play one of the songs for which he was most famous. It's called Half a Pint of Ale. It's recorded in 1931, one of his later recordings, because he did actually record earlier in his, as it were, first career too. But obviously the later ones were recorded with a microphone and easier to listen to. This one's a cracker. There's also a film of him doing this, so you can actually watch him doing this. And no doubt it's on YouTube, everything else is. So, with no more ado, I give you a recording in 1931 by Gus Elan of Half a Pint of Ale.
I hate those chaps what talks about the things what they likes to drink, such as tea and coffee, cocoa and milk. Why, of such things I never think. I'm plain in me habits and I'm plain in me food, and what I says is this, that the man what drinks such rubbish with his meals, well, I always gives him a miss. Now for breakfast I never think of having tea. I likes me half a pint of ale. For dinner I likes a little bit of meat and half a pint of ale. For tea I likes a little bit of fish and half a pint of ale. And for supper I likes a crust of bread and cheese and a pint and an half of ale. Now this is how I looks at it, and I think you'll agree with me. I've never seen a man get drunk in my life on cocoa, coffee or tea. Do you think I'd pay 1 and 8 a pound for tea? Well, the thought makes me feel queer when I think of what you get for another 2 and 6, such a pretty little barrel of beer. Now for breakfast I never think of having tea. I likes me half a pint of ale. For dinner I likes a little bit of meat and half a pint of ale. For tea I likes a little bit of fish and half a pint of ale. And for supper I likes a crust of bread and cheese and a galley and an half of ale. Now folks, what drink such stuff as that are all as looking pale. They've pains in their tummies and they've pains in their back, but I never have a pain with ale. I always feels happy and I always feels right when I've had a glass or two. So why should I drink coffee or tea when there's plenty of ale, would you? Now for breakfast I never think of having tea. I likes me half a pint of ale. For dinner I likes a little bit of meat and half a pint of ale. For tea I likes a little bit of fish and half a pint of ale. And for supper I likes a crust of bread and cheese and a barrel and an half of ale.
Gus Elan, one of the great, great stars of the English music hall 100 years ago. And from there we go to something, well, equally great, but of a totally different nature. A couple of programs ago, I played you a recording of Cole Porter singing one of his own songs. George Gershwin didn't sing. Apparently he had a terrible voice, or so I understand. However, he was a fine, fine pianist. Reading about him recently, it seems that he was a man of unbounded self-confidence, to the point where, not exactly big-headed, but he just sort of expected everybody to want to hear him play, and when he played, he only played his own music, and he would sit down at parties and play the whole evening. That's the sort of person he was. And just in the same way that he expected women to fall into his arms. They didn't always, but he had a fairly high hit rate because of that confidence. He was that sort of man. He also had limitations. He was obviously a great songwriter and a fine pianist, but I don't think he ever really understood jazz, and when you hear his own playing of his own songs, interesting and fascinating and musical though his performances are, they're a little bit hidebound in the strict dance music of his day. Of course, he used the word jazz to mean anything that wasn't classical music of the time. But with hindsight, we call jazz a certain sort of swing, a certain sort of feel. And his rhythm is a bit relentless, at least I think so. Nevertheless, when you hear him play his own songs, it gives you a real insight into how he wrote the stuff, what it was meant for, and of course the way music was, the way popular music was at that time in the 20s. So I'm going to play for you now a record of him in 1928 playing on the piano two of his hit songs. Those songs are Swanderful and another song called Funny Face. This was recorded on the 12th of June 1928 when he was 29 years old, and as we all know, he only had 10 years to live. He died very young. Brain tumour, sadly. So here is George Gershwin at the peak of his fame and power, playing the piano in a way that could only be George Gershwin. 1928, George Gershwin, here you are. Thank you. George Gershwin and a fascinating look into the world that he wrote for, which was, of course, the world of musical comedies, the shows that contained all those hit songs that we now know so well. And that's the way he intended them to be played originally. Fascinating. Well, earlier in this program, when I was talking about Florencio Constantino, I did say that sometimes he sounded like a sort of miniature version of Francesco Tamagno, and it suddenly struck me that people who are not opera buffs like me and 78 collectors will have no idea who Francesco Tamagno was. Tamagno was simply one of the great tenors of the late 19th century. He was what the Italians call a tenore di forza, a massive voice. If you think Pavarotti was the king of the high seas, wait till you hear Tamagno. He was a truly great tenor, and although Verdi used to make remarks about him being not that bright, I think that was just the typical composer making fun of the singer situation, because there's a very famous story about Tamagno when he was in his 40s and just about the most famous tenor in Italy. He'd heard about a new young tenor who was starting up, and they were doing a sort of revival of what was regarded as a very old-fashioned opera at that time, with the new operas of Puccini and Mascagni taking everything by storm. Performing L'Elisir d'Amore by Donizetti was regarded as very old hat, a comic opera to boot. So he went along and to hear what all the fuss was about with this young tenor, and when he came out, one of the local journalists recognized him and asked him what he thought of the new tenor. And what he said on that occasion reveals him to be certainly not a man of high ego, certainly an intelligent man and a generous man, because what he said was this: if this young Neapolitan continues to sing like this, he will be greater than any of us. And of course he was right, because that young Neapolitan was, of course, the 22-year-old or 23-year-old, whatever he was, Enrico Caruso. Of course, Caruso could never match the clarion brilliance of Tamagno's pure tenor voice. Caruso was always a golden-throated baritone tenor. In a way, you can't compare the two. Caruso only was considering playing Otello right at the end of his career, and never lived to do so. Tamagno was the Otello. He created the role for Verdi in 1883, and he's absolutely phenomenal. However, I'm not going to give you one of his famous Otello recordings. I'm going to play you his version of the Improvviso, the aria from Andrea Chenier. And here you hear him using his mezza voce, his half voice, which, however, is louder than most other people's full voice. It was an amazing voice, yet he's no belter. He really is a very intelligent, subtle singer. Nevertheless, this was recorded around 1903 or 4, I've forgotten which, because he died in 1905. He had heart problems. He was, therefore, since he was born in 1850, he would have been about 54 when he recorded this, and already not a well man. That you can't tell this, of course, from his singing. When Caruso recorded it, however, just 2 or 3 years later, it was like a new era dawning. He sang it and phrased it in a completely different way, and it just is better. You wouldn't think that it could be better than this version, because this is a great 19th century singer, and he sings it in the 19th century way, supreme 19th century tenor for this sort of thing, you might say. But of course, Caruso was the future. Maybe in a future program, I will play Caruso's version for comparison. But here now is Francesco Tamagno, one of the few recordings he made for the recording horn. Before I play you the record, though, I should do a little advert, and it's not for me. There is a company called Historic Masters who, on a very small budget, have managed to keep going for about 20 or 30 years or more. What they do is they find original masters for these old 78, occasionally finding ones they didn't even know existed, and then they press them not onto shellac but onto vinyl. So you get vinyl 78s pressed from original masters. Last year, they brought out a complete set of the 12-inch recordings by Francesco Tamagno, including this one and a complete find, the Vengeance duet from Otello, which nobody knew that he'd recorded. And they don't know who the baritone is, and they surmise it might be his brother. However, if you like the sound of Tamagno, you really ought to get in touch with Historic Masters. They're on the web, and buy this box of amazing recordings. How amazing? Well, just listen to this record now.
All'azzurro spazio guardai profondo e ai prati colmi di viole pioveva loro il sole. che d'or, e a lei serviva di scrigno il firmamento. Su dalla terra alla mia fronte veniva una carezza viva, un bacio. Gridai, vinto d'amor, a t'amo. Tu che mi baci divinamente, bella, oh patria mia. E volli pien d'amore pregar, varcai d'una chiesa la soglia, là un prete nelle nicchie dei santi e della Vergine accumulava doni. E al sordo orecchio un tremolo vegliardo in van chiedeva pane, in van stendeva la mano. Varcai degli abitori l'uscio, un uom vi calunniava bestemmiando il suolo, che l'erario appena sazia e contro Dio scagliava e contro gli uomini le lacrime dei figli. In cotanta miseria la patrizia prole che fa, sol l'occhio vostro esprime umanamente qui un guardo di pietà. Ond'io guardato a voi, siccome un angelo, e dissi, ecco la bellezza della vita. Ma poi alle vostre parole un novello dolor m'ha colto in pieno petto. Oh giovinezza bella, d'un poeta non disprezzate il detto. Udite, non conoscete amor, amor. Divino dono, non lo schernir del mondo, anima e vita,
one of the truly great singers in opera, Francesco Tamagno. There is a film that Beniamino Gigli made in the late 30s. Let's call it 1938 for the sake of argument. And in the film they talk of three great tenors. The first one, of course, was Beniamino Gigli, has to be. And he was just about the leading tenor in the world at that time. The second one that they mention is, of course, Caruso, who had only died 17 years before. But surprisingly, the third one that they mention was indeed Francesco Tamagno, who by that time had been dead for 34 years. Well, of course, we still listen back to Caruso now, but he lived much longer and made lots of records, many with orchestra, and we've had lots of different technological things done to those recordings. Tamagno only made these couple of dozen records with piano only back before 1905, so it's astonishing that he was still remembered as being the great tenor of his time. Well, I've got to follow that. I would have to provide my own song. I'm actually doing this show in September because ahead of me I've got a trip to Singapore where I've got to sing at a jazz ball and then a variety show in Ireland when I get back. I'm waiting to hear also whether or not I will be performing in Brazil. Well, in Singapore, I'm going to sing a bossa nova. I haven't decided which yet. So maybe that's all telling me that this time I should be playing for you one of my bossa novas. This one is called Madrugada. That's the Portuguese word for dawn. But in my song, it represents as if part of one of those semi-African religions that they have in Brazil, the spirit, the goddess of dawn, as if it's a living creature. So here's my song, Madrugada. As always, if you'd like to write to me, complain, request, whatever you want to say, the email address is spats47@ntlworld.com. And next time, it'll be the 1st of December, and I'm going to do the ultimate Christmas program, all culled from 78s. So until next time, I'm signing off. This is Earl Oaken, and this is my song, Madrugada.
Early morning sun pours across the trembling sky like summer wine. So is love begun. As I touch your lips, I know that you are mine. Or is it only madrugada, spinning dreams around my madrugada, just pretending, whispering that we will never part. Something in your eyes seemed to wake a dream forgotten deep inside. Took me by surprise, offering the love that always seemed denied. Or was it only madrugada, casting spells into the air? Only madrugada, weaving magic, mingling with the perfume of your hair. Walking on the sand and sharing secrets only we could understand. And yet the fading light is so deceiving. In the moonlight, seeing is believing. Finally the dawn for my trembling lips. At last a lover's kiss. So my love is born. You are in my arms. There is no world but this. Or is it only madrugada, just a star to wish upon? After madrugada, will I wake to find you gone? Thank you. walking on the sand and sharing secrets only we could understand. And yet the fading light is so deceiving. In the moonlight, seeing is believing. Finally the dawn for my trembling lips, at last a lover's kiss. So my love is born, you are in my arms, there is no world but this. Or is it only madrugada, just a star to wish upon? After madrugada, will I wake to find you gone?